From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, our critics look back at the year in pop culture. Rock critic Ken Tucker will be here with his top 10 list, and he'll play some of his favorite recordings for us. Stephen Schiff will look back on the year in film and pick his top 10. And TV critic David Bianculli will discuss some of the most interesting programs and revealing trends of 1995. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton has suspended economic sanctions against Serbia and Montenegro, saying they had achieved their goal of encouraging an end to warfare in the Balkans. Mr. Clinton says the sanctions could be reimposed if NATO officials determine the Bosnian Serbs are not meeting their obligations under the peace accord. NATO's top military commander says he's very pleased with the way the warring parties in Bosnia are complying with the peace accord so far. U.S. Army General George Juwan notes that Serb and Muslim fighters have pulled back from frontline positions in Sarajevo and that mines are being removed. He also says U.S. troops moving into Bosnia from Serbia are encountering no problems. Juwan spoke during a visit to Serbia. But there are some difficulties. U.S. Army engineers are still struggling to build a pontoon bridge across the rain-swollen Sava River. NPR's Tom Jelton has more.
U.S. Army engineers were set to build a pontoon bridge across the river Sava, separating Croatia from Bosnia. Their base camp along the edges of the river was flooded today and had to be evacuated. This will undoubtedly further set back the timeline for completing that bridge and therefore also set back the time for deploying U.S. ground forces into Bosnia.
Most of the 20,000 U.S. troops destined for Bosnia are slated to enter the country over the bridge from Croatia. Federal authorities in Nevada are arresting two men on charges of planting a powerful bomb at the Internal Revenue Service building in Reno earlier this month. The fuse to the bomb was lit, but the explosives failed to detonate. In a statement announcing the arrest, investigators gave no motive for the attempted bombing. The explosives, which were reportedly similar to those used in the Oklahoma City blast, were packed in a plastic drum that was found in a parking lot outside the building. More details have emerged about the final moments of the U.S. airliner that crashed in Colombia last week. Authorities say the plane's pilot failed to release air brakes applied for landing when he gunned the engines for an invasive maneuver. Tomas Cabal has more from Cali.
Colombian officials have ruled out sabotage, mechanical deficiencies, or weather conditions as the cause of the crash of an American Airlines plane last week. The accident, which killed 160 passengers, occurred minutes before landing at Cali International Airport. According to Colombian civil aeronautics officials, an alarm sounded in the cabin of the Boeing 757 just 9 seconds before impact. The alarm instructed the pilot to pull up since the crash was imminent. No reasons have been given why the jetliner was 13 miles off course in a valley ringed by very high mountains. The investigation will continue in the hopes of clarifying what led to the destruction of the aircraft. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Cali, Colombia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 4.5 points. This is NPR. With the partial government shutdown nearing the end of its second week, White House and congressional staff members are holding lengthy discussions about possible solutions to the budget impasse. They're laying the groundwork for a meeting of top budget negotiators tomorrow. More than 250,000 federal workers remain off the job. Authorities are trying to ward off a new disaster in a flood-ravaged part of eastern South Africa. They're distributing chlorine tablets to prevent waterborne disease such as cholera and typhoid. The death toll from this week's flooding stands at 123. The trial of three U.S. servicemen accused of raping a Japanese schoolgirl in Okinawa has been postponed after the mothers of the defendants asked for a change of venue. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Okinawa.
The three-judge panel was to have heard closing arguments today in the trial that has focused international attention and local fury on the U.S. military in Okinawa. But a last-minute motion filed by the mothers of the two defendants managed to win a chance to have the high court at least hear a motion to move the case. The chief judge of the panel in the district court hearing evidence in the rape case said the new development would mean all proceedings in the trial would be suspended until the high court ruled. Legal experts say defense attempts to move the trial for fear that a fair verdict cannot be rendered are unlikely to succeed, and a delay in a verdict is all the defendants can really hope to achieve. In Okinawa, this is Julie McCarthy.
A moderate earthquake rattled the Lake Tahoe area today along the California-Nevada border. The tremor measured 5 on the Richter scale. No reports of injuries or damage. Prison inmates in California are being barred from meeting reporters face-to-face. The ban applies to all 135,000 prisoners in state facilities. Authorities say they're concerned that media exposure glamorizes criminals and turns them into celebrities or heroes. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's something of a Fresh Air tradition to end the year by asking some of our critics to stop by with their 10 best lists. Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker is here to play some of the recordings on his 10 best list. You might want to get out a pen and paper because after he plays some of his picks, he'll run through the whole list. Happy New Year, Ken.
Same to you.
Let's open with your record of the year, and that way we won't have to pretend we're building up to a thrilling climax.
Right. My record of the year is Matthew Sweet's 100% Fun. To me, this was the record that got me through ups and downs, because it just lasts through the whole year. It's got just a lot of really good, strong melodies, a lot of really raw guitar playing. I really like the kind of sweet and sour quality to it, the way he has these very sweet tunes sung with this very sour sensibility. I think he's just a really good singer-songwriter. And the cut I'd like to play is called Sick of Myself.
Matthew Sweet from his CD 100% Fun, which is number one on our rock critic Ken Tucker's top 10 list of 1995. Ken, any big events in music or the music industry in 1995 that you want to make note of, for better or worse?
Well, to me, it was a year of big non-events. I mean, the things that got publicity were the things that, to me, were least interesting about the year. I'm thinking about things like, well, on a musical level, the extraordinary commercial success of Hootie and the Blowfish, 11 million copies sold of completely derivative, pleasant, unremarkable sort of music. There were events like the opening of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a place that I cannot imagine I would less want to visit. I guess I would go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame the way I might go to Las Vegas as a goof. But to me, to sort of enshrine stuff and go there and ponder it seems to me to be antithetical to the spirit of the music. And then there were things like, the sudden resurrection of the Beatles. ABC ran the 6-hour documentary on television, and their greatest hits collection suddenly vaulted into the number one position. But it didn't. The TV special failed for me because it failed to place them in any kind of new context or to tell us anything new about the Beatles. There were also artists that got a lot of attention that failed to sort of back it up with the work. I mean, Michael Jackson made a tremendous splash in the middle of the year with this collection called History, and the new material on it really wasn't worthy of him particularly. And I also thought that Bruce Springsteen's release was a relative failure. I mean, I thought it was indicative of the kind of exhaustion in his style that he would put out this very slow, maundering sort of folk record.
Well, several of the trends or non-events that you mentioned were really orchestrated by the PR industry as opposed to being the kind of event because music is great and people just fall in love with it.
Yeah.
And something changes musically or culturally.
Yeah, I think that's true. And anything like that, it can't be orchestrated. It's something that has to happen. I mean, we certainly learned that just a few years ago with the success of Nirvana, a band that just came out of nowhere that the music industry had no idea would do as well as it did, and yet it ended up, you know, changing the face of popular music for the year and a half that it was a very vital commercial group.
Why don't we get to another record from your top 10 list?
Yeah, I have one by an old-timer named Neil Young, who got together with a bunch of whippersnappers called Pearl Jam, and they put out an album called Mirror Ball, which is really a terrific album. Neil Young is one of those guys, you know, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame who has refused to be ossified, refused to be categorized. I think he's still making really strong, vital music. The cut I'd like to play is called Downtown.
Neil Young from the CD Mirror Ball, and joining us is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and he's playing us some recordings from his top 10 list from 1995. Well, can you mention some of the non-events of 1995? Any interesting new ideas to mention in pop?
Well, certainly the most pervasive theme I've read in terms of pop music coverage this year is this whole idea of authenticity. The idea of, you know, the two most interesting things I read all year, one was from Art Forum, and another was a piece in The Source, which is a magazine about rap music. In both places, cultural critics debated the idea of whether the person performing the song really had to be that person, whether the person and the persona were the same, whether this kind of straitjacket of whether your image had to be you. In terms of gangster rappers, there's a very fierce debate among African-American music critics about whether, you know, do you have to be a thug to sing about this sort of thuggishness? And the piece in Art Forum by the English critic John Savage made the point that someone like Bruce Springsteen is just straitjacketed by the idea that he has to now, as a multimillionaire, suddenly divest himself of his wealth and fame and become this working-class hero every time he walks into the recording studio. To me, that does seem to be one reason why someone like Springsteen makes such constricted music at this point, because he just doesn't feel that freedom. I think a lot of pop groups in England especially are very aware of this kind of idea, and a band like Oasis, this young pop band, feels free to take from the whole history of rock and roll. You know, they're very influenced by the Beatles, very influenced by 70s punk rock, very influenced by recent grunge music, and recombines things. I think that increasingly what you're going to see in and hear in pop music is this whole notion of the past as existing as contemporaneous with the present and the future, that the idea is to collapse the past and reconfigure it and use it to your purposes rather than forever sort of echo and venerate what went on in the past. And this band Oasis, I think, does a very good job. They put out an album called What's the Story, Morning Glory, and the cut of theirs that I'd like to play is called Roll With It.
And this is on your 10 best list?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
That's Oasis from their CD, What's the Story, Morning Glory. We'll be back with more of Ken Tucker's Top 10 after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're looking back on the year in pop with Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker. He's also a critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Any interesting developments in hip-hop?
Yeah, I think one thing is that there was a lot more melody in hip-hop, a lot more use of the kind of strong rhythm sections and beats that gangster rap has brought to the fore, but applying much more melody to it. In this country, a rapper named Coolio, over in England, a rapper named Tricky, his brand of hip-hop is a kind of dreamy, sort of druggy genre called trip-hop. Over here, Coolio had what I think is the single of the year called Gangsta's Paradise. It was originally from the soundtrack to the movie Dangerous Minds, and it takes a melody from Stevie Wonder, again, you know, 15 years ago, and applies it to the present. And I think Gangsta's Paradise became this wonderful sort of anthem for the year.
Well, why don't we hear it?
Sounds good.
As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's nothing left. Cause I've been blasting and laughing so long that even my mama thinks that my mind is gone. But I ain't never crossed a man that didn't deserve it. Me be treated like a punk, you know that's unheard of. You better watch how you're talking and where you're walking, or you and your homies might be lying in chalk. I really hate the trip, but I gotta low. As they croak, I see myself in the pistol smoke. Fool, I'm the kind of G the little homies wanna be like, on my knees in the night, saying prayers in the streetlight.
Ken, do you think that Coolio record relates to what you were talking about before about authenticity?
Yeah, I think it's a real example of an artist taking advantage of music from the past and not being intimidated by the heritage of the music, using it for his own purposes and bringing it up to date.
Any other trends or directions you want to mention?
Well, I think that you really saw the emergence this year of a number of women in very strong commercial positions. Mm-hmm. Certainly the year began with Sheryl Crow winning a slew of Grammy Awards. You know, here was a new artist who people didn't really expect on her first album out to have quite so many hit singles. I think that there was a very strong debut by a woman named Joan Osborne that I reviewed here on the show. The same with Alanis Morissette, this young Canadian singer-songwriter who, again, for a debut album, suddenly yielded at least four or five hit singles. Melissa Etheridge, I also think, is an interesting case of a woman who's completely co-opted very strong male hard rock sound and turned it into, you know, a top five act. She sells millions and millions of records. A woman who's openly gay and yet can still completely relate to that adolescent male audience whom you wouldn't think would relate to a woman artist. And she's done remarkably well. My own particular favorites by women artists that are on my list this year aren't as necessarily as commercially successful, but I think they're both very, very worthy records. One of them is by a Los Angeles band called The Muffs, and it's a really delightful record called Blonder and Blonder. The cut I'd like to play from that is called Lying on a Bed of Roses.
Yeah.
that song by the Muffs. It's like the best Joan Jett record that Joan Jett never cut. You know, it's got full of energy. I like it a lot.
You know what I find interesting? I think some of the more commercially successful female singer-songwriters of the past year or so sing in a very high, almost childlike voice, very nasal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, the opposite. It's really guttural and strong and loud,
yeah.
Raspy.
Yeah.
Are the Muffs the only women on your 10 best list?
No. Much to my surprise, Katie Lang is on this list.
Oh, you're surprised there's another woman.
No.
Oh, you're surprised it's Katie Lang.
Yes.
So
yes. I haven't been a big Katie Lang fan. To me, at the beginning of her career when she was putting out that pseudo Patsy Cline stuff, I thought it was awful and campy, and I really disliked it. Then when she, you know, willfully turned herself into a torch singer, I thought that was very tortured and annoying. But recently she's begun to sing, I think, sort of much more straightforwardly without these trappings of irony. And this latest album called All You Can Eat, I think is really terrific. It's very, really nice middle-of-the-road ballads that I think work very well. And she sings them very straightforwardly without any of the campiness that used to infect her other records. The cut I'd like to play from All You Can Eat is a song called Acquiesce.
These immoral questions. What on earth are we to do? Offer our confessions, offer ourselves to you.
Katie Lang, Ken, do you think she's become a better songwriter?
Yeah, I think so. She's written most of the material on this record, and I think she's really shown a lot of strength in that area. It's not so much covering older material, but kind of dealing with things that she wants to deal with in a song.
Now, I know you listen to a lot of country music. Did any country CDs make it onto your 10 best list?
You betcha. Dwight Yoakam continues to be my man. Dwight Yoakam, I think, is another example of this issue of authenticity. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, Greil Marcus accusing Dwight Yoakam of being a big phony and dismissing him in a rock critic jeremiad. But, you know, to me, that's one of the interesting things about Dwight Yoakam is that he doesn't present himself as somebody fresh out of the hills, you know. He's a really sophisticated guy, and I think on his new album called Gone, he does some really interesting things. He combines not just country music and honky-tonk, but also a lot of black music soul styles. In fact, the cut I'd like to play called Nothing, I think you'll hear in the arrangement, it sounds like a Willie Mitchell, Al Green cut from the mid-70s in its use of percussion and bass.
I couldn't change your heart. I couldn't change your mind. So I just had to learn to live with this empty life you left behind. You didn't try to hear. You didn't try to see. No, you just stared right through the teardrop like there was nothing left of me. Nothing but sorrow. Nothing but pain. Nothing but memories whisper your
That's Dwight Yoakam, his CD Gone, and it's on Ken Tucker's list of the best CDs of 1995. In fact, Ken, we're not going to have time to hear excerpts of all the CDs on your top 10 list, but I'd really like it if you could just like run through the list so everybody who wants to have a copy of your list could get out their pen and some paper now and jot it down. Is this in any order that you're going
to
give it?
Yeah, it is. My order of preference from top to bottom.
Okay.
Matthew Sweet, 100% Fun, is number one as far as I'm concerned, followed by Neil Young's Mirror Ball, Oasis, and that collection is called What's the Story, Morning Glory, Dwight Yoakam's Gone, R. Kelly, soul singer who put out an album called R. Kelly, a really good live album, another country record called Hurt City by a guy named Stacey Dean Campbell. It's his second album, Hurt City. I think it's a really good old-fashioned honky-tonk record. Smashing Pumpkins put out a double CD called Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, possibly the worst title of the year, but some of the best music. Rancid, a kind of a nouveau punk band, put out a collection called And Out Come the Wolves that I think was very strong. And then the two acts that we have played, The Muffs, Blonder and Blonder, and K.D. Lang's All You Can Eat.
Well, great. Ken, thanks for being with us and for sharing your list of the best records of 1995.
Well, thanks.
I want to wish you a real happy new year.
Well, same to you, Terry.
Thank you. Ken Tucker is rock critic for Fresh Air and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And Ken, why don't we go out with some more music from your 10 best list? Is there a CD you'd like to feature to bring us out?
Yeah, I think we should go out on some Smashing Pumpkins.
Great.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our look back at 1995. TV critic David Bianculli discusses the most interesting programs and the most revealing trends of the year. And film critic Stephen Schiff has his top 10 list, as well as some thoughts on the year in film. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've asked some of our critics to look back on 1995. In the world of television, every new year brings not only new shows, but new channels. Our TV critic David Bianculli has tried to make sense of some of the changes 1995 brought to television. David, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
What are some of your picks for the best shows of 1995?
Well, it's easy because there weren't many. American Gothic, I guess, of the ones that came in the new season, was my absolute favorite because it surprised me every single week with what it was trying to do. It was just so weird and strange. Murder One, I really liked the concept of, but there were things I didn't like about it as well, including the stupid subplots that they kept because they figured that audiences wouldn't stay tuned every week just with the main. Every time they went off on one of those tangents, I got annoyed, like, go back to the main case, because they weren't written as well and they just slowed things down.
What about shows that have been on a while that used to be really good and are now deteriorating?
It's funny because Picket Fences was always one of my absolute favorite shows. David E. Kelley wrote it brilliantly. Then he left and quit writing it. And the new producers, or the promoted producers, decided to get away from all of the issue thoughtful stuff and really delve into the lives of these characters in this town. And they delved into the wrong lives. They all did things that I don't think that David Kelley would have them do, I wouldn't have had them do. And most fans that I've talked to or had letters from about Picket Fences just say, what has happened to this show this year? Flip side, Seinfeld has really gotten good again, where it had deteriorated. You know, the soup Nazi episode is one of the best of all time for Seinfeld.
It seems to me every time I put on the TV, there's a bunch of people in their 20s or 30s sitting around talking.
Yes, yes.
What is it Friends or Seinfeld that's motivating all of this?
Well, Seinfeld motivated Friends. It's sort of like the biblical begat. You know, Seinfeld's begat Friends, and Friends begat just about every sitcom that's on the tube. And there's some time slot hits, like, you know, Caroline in the City and The Single Guy, which are in the top 10, top 15, purely because of where they are on NBC's powerful schedule. But network programmers are going to say, oh, look, there is still an appetite for these kinds of shows, so we're not quite through with these, even though most of them failed.
Do you like Friends? Do you think it deserves the incredible success it has?
I like the way it's written. I like the performers. I have no problem with Friends. I don't think that it's, it is an overrated show because it's just a sitcom, and it's not as brilliant as everybody's making it out to be, but I enjoy watching it.
We're looking back on the year on television with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. I guess like the really big event on television this year was the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
What was the lesson of the O.J. trial that the networks took away?
They took away, I guess, two lessons. One that I don't like is that they could do the same sort of reporting as the tabloids or TV tabloids and viewers would respond. In a lot of those stories, they were driven by the hard copies and the National Enquirer kind of leads and brought up. And it seemed like once it was reported anywhere in the O.J. story, it was fair game to come out. There was, it was really overkill journalistically in that sense, and we've sort of settled a little lower in what we accept as journalistic standards. That's the bad thing. I think the good thing is that tangentially, they had to staff so many people on this story that rather than let them go when it was through, the bureaus are actually doing different kinds of news again. I mean, O.J. Simpson was such an incredible part of the news whole every day that with it gone, it's almost refreshing to watch a newscast. And, sidelight, the O.J. Simpson story on Fox was one of those awful quickie telemovies that finally drove a nail in the quickie telemovies, along with the two Roseannes and the couple of Madonnas. You know, after just a few years ago, there were three Amy Fishers. I think we're sort of through with that now for a while.
The whole communications industry seems to be realigning and reshaping itself. This is happening in television. There's a bunch of mergers that have been recently announced. Why don't you run through what the mergers are?
Oh, man. Let me see. Okay, we got Group W and CBS. I'm doing this off the top. We got Disney and ABC. We've got NBC, which is working with Bill Gates and Microsoft now.
What's behind these mergers?
Panic for the 21st century. And it's the same thing that's driving these 24-hour news station ideas that NBC and ABC has already announced, and CBS undoubtedly will, to rival Ted Turner with cable 24 hours somewhere. There's two reasons. One is that there's a sudden awareness that rather than just making broadcasting the only business and making it United States broadcasting, it's a global war now, and that you've got to get on, you know, satellites in Asia and in England and all of these places and provide something. So there's this synergy going on, and everybody wants to link with everybody else so that they all have a dance to go to in the 21st century. And my particular theory about this, which may be ridiculous, is that news and sports are the only things that networks will be able to deliver or have to deliver in real time that people will still want, no matter how it's delivered. In about 10, 15 years, I think that those of us, you know, who want to have it could, like, have the networks downloaded once a week, have all your entertainment shows, and you could watch them when you want to. They'd probably still have commercials in them that you'd have to fast-forward through. But you could pick what you wanted to watch when you wanted to watch it, but you can't do that with news, and you can't do that with sports. So that's the software that's really going to be valuable.
What has succeeded on cable this year that might have an effect on the direction cable heads in, and also what's failed on cable that might also have an effect?
Well, the successes on cable are the things that either the networks are not providing or are not providing well. Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher is a major surprise success on Comedy Central. I mean, it doesn't really belong on that network. It could go just about anywhere. And the buzz is that it may end up after Ted Koppel on ABC after Nightline, and that would be a great mix. But here's a talk show where, unlike most of the ones that are on television, nobody's plugging anything. There's specific topics, and they're actually talking about real issues, and you get to see people from different walks of life, not just the same old celebrities, and having to give and then defend positions. So that's a neat show. And then you have Larry Sanders doing brilliant comedy of the stuff that I fear the networks will never be able to provide, just because it's so raw, it's so adult, it's so real, and it hurts so many feelings. But that sort of stuff is very important to those franchises.
Now, Nick at Night has been very successful,
yes,
hasn't it?
Yes, I love... Reruns? Yeah, and they're starting a new network in 96. This is probably the early 96 best thing. They're going to, except that then you've got to find out if it's ever going to be shown on your cable system. But a new 24-hour Nick network called Television Land for more or less adults and teens. It's just, you know, because what Nick does so beautifully, in the daytime, it starts you off as a toddler. Every few hours, the shows get a little bit older, gets you up to Nick at Night and keeps you there. And SNCC is a wonderful thing on Saturdays. Now you've got a whole other network where they're going to move Hill Street. They're going to take all these shows, you know, old variety shows, I think like Sonny and Cher are going to be on there. Just a whole weird old viewing experience carrying on the Nick at Night thing. Now, I have a satellite dish that will get it immediately, and I'm pretty sure I'm just going to be rolling tape, you know, and that satellite dish is going to be dedicated to that network. I mean, I love television's history. And I think that while the networks aren't even acknowledging what it has or what it had, cable, again, is leading the way.
Well, David, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And I wish you a very happy New Year.
You too.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Fresh Air and the New York Daily News. Coming up, Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff with his top 10 list. This is Fresh Air. We asked our film critic Stephen Schiff to look back on the year in film. Stephen is also critic at large for The New Yorker. Let's start with his top 10 list.
This is a year in which there were a lot of movies that, to me, were very mixed bags. They had, you know, enormous achievements mixed with enormous failures. And that sort of sensibility runs through most of the top ten. I say that because it's necessary to say that to preface the number 10 choice, which is Nixon by Oliver Stone, which in many ways, which has enormous flaws, but enormous strengths as well. And I thought it was a very, very impressive movie on the whole. We're seeing now a very interesting anti-Oliver backlash, I think. In other words, the knee-jerk reaction against Oliver Stone's movies is now being questioned by perhaps an equally knee-jerk questioning of the constant criticism of Oliver just because he's Oliver, which is an interesting phenomenon. But in any case, Nixon was my number 10 film. Number 9 was Burnt by the Sun, the Nikita Mikhalkov film about Russia in the early days of Stalinism. Very beautiful film, which won the Academy Award last year. Number 8 was, I thought, one of the better independent films this year, Exotica by Adam Egoyan, whose films had not previously impressed me. This one was really, really fine and beautifully made. Now I'm going to cheat on number 7 because I wanted to get more on the list. And this was a very good year for children's movies. So I threw 3 into the number 7 category. Babe by Chris Noonan, Toy Story by John Larrabee, and A Little Princess by Alfonso Cuarón. And you could argue that there were a number of other pretty good children's movies. These were exceptional children's movies in a really good year for them. Number 6, Get Shorty, Barry Sonnenfeld's delicious crime comedy of Hollywood. Number 5, a movie that is just opening in New York and Los Angeles, and I don't know how many markets it'll get wider, Terry Gilliam's new movie, 12 Monkeys, which is a time-traveling sort of fantasy comedy horror movie that's extremely interesting. Number 4, again, I'm cheating. I'm throwing together the Jane Austen movies, Sense and Sensibility, Ang Lee's version from the Emma Thompson screenplay, and Persuasion, the BBC version directed by Roger Mitchell. Number 3, Safe, by Todd Haynes, a very, very fine movie from another surprise for me from a director from whom I hadn't seen much that impressed me, a movie about Anno Me that had a very beautiful look, beautiful performance by Julianne Moore, and a dark undercurrent that was very subversive. Number 2, Leaving Las Vegas, the best fiction film of the year, I thought, and a remarkable story in itself, made for $3.5 million, picked up by MGM for $1 million. Mike Figgis wrote and directed it as a labor of love. It has the two best performances by a man and a woman of the year, I thought, Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue, and was just a very beautiful, romantic, dark, tragic, lovely, moving movie. And the best movie of the year, which had all those qualities and more, was a documentary. It was Terry Zwigoff's documentary, Crumb.
Any runners-up?
Well, there are a lot of, sort of bubbling under movies. I liked Before the Rain, the Milko Manchevsky three-part movie that had such an interesting time structure, and another sort of country heard from. The Bridges of Madison County, a very, very fine version of something we thought there could not be a very fine version of. Heat, Michael Mann's very strong and beautifully made crime movie. Clueless, the seeming teen film that was an actual adaptation, another adaptation from Jane Austen, and that was really very brightly funny and made Alicia Silverstone a star. Kiss of Death, Barbe Schroeder's crime movie. Wild Bill, a Western that flopped at the box office, but that I thought was very interesting, by Walter Hill. A movie called Funny Bones that just dropped out of sight, by Peter Chelsom, who did Hear My Song a few years ago. Very interesting comedy. The Usual Suspects, which I thought wound up being overrated, but is still a very interesting crime movie. Unzipped, the terrific documentary about the fashion industry. A couple other independent films, Kicking and Screaming, Noah Baumbach's story of life right after school when you can't quite leave school. And Living in Oblivion, Tom DiCillo's movie about making a movie the hard way.
Stephen, reviewing your 10 best list, there's several films there with dark themes.
Yeah, it's true. This was a year when the grimness got loose. A year of rampant grimness in the movies. In fact, one of the movie's big surprise hits, 7, was famous for being so grim and dark and difficult to take. And you had 12 Monkeys, you had Copycat, Leaving Las Vegas, Georgia, The Crossing Guard, Dead Man Walking, which is opening just now. I mean, these are downers, and Hollywood wisdom has always been no downers, please. You know, everything has to have a happy ending, even The Scarlet Letter. So this was kind of a surprise, and in some ways I thought it was a pleasant surprise, but again, it has a way of going awry. Seven was, I thought, kind of a stupid movie, and grimness became a stylistic overlay, sort of used to paint it up into something more than it was. It seemed an attempt to make a trivial movie look more significant, and it worked for audiences. And I mean, I'm grateful that it didn't have a happy ending, I'm grateful that we don't always have to have happy endings anymore. I mean, I think Othello, Richard III, these movies will look very bad with happy endings, and a lot of other movies will too. And if grimness, darkness in and of itself does not turn an audience away, I think that's a good thing. On the other hand, once you sort of turn it into a device like any other or a cliche like any other, then it becomes as empty as any other cliche or device.
I will just say about Seven, like it or not, that Morgan Freeman's performance I thought was quite good.
It was quite good. Yeah. But of course, it's Brad Pitt who's getting the rise from it, and people are saying, well, see, you put Brad Pitt in anything, and he'll make a hit.
Yes,
I think
well.
Brad is a candidate for a little award that I have. It's the, for actors only, it's the just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it award. You'll see Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys giving a twitchy performance, wild performance. Of course, unexpected. It's not a sexy performance. It's not you know, sort of something for teenage girls to dream about. But every scene is full of twitches and ticks, and it's true he plays a crazy person in it. But it's overacting of a certain kind, a kind we also saw from another winner of that award. I would think Al Pacino in Heat. Whose philosophy seemed to be, just when you think it should be quiet, I'm going to be loud! And Jennifer Jason Leigh, in a couple movies, but particularly in Georgia, you know, being very drunk and very morose and very, you know, all these are extraordinary actors. They have extraordinary technique. But again, just because they have it doesn't mean it should be employed in scene after scene.
I often look for interesting performances by women at the movies, because there's so few of them. It's so exciting when a good actress finds a really good role. What I mean is that there's so few good roles for women in films now. And one of my favorite performances by an actress this year is in one of your top 10 films, and I'm thinking of Julianne Moore's performance in Safe. And I thought it was really interesting that she gave such an extraordinary performance in Safe, yet in her big commercial film, A 9 Months, the comedy with Hugh Grant, it was such an uninteresting role as written. I don't think there was much you could actually do with it. And I thought, gee, this must say something about the plight of actresses, that there's interesting roles in the independent films, but so few interesting roles in the bigger commercial films.
Well, in some ways, it's not a good year to talk about the plight of actresses, because they had better roles this year than in maybe any year of the last decade or so, and maybe longer. And they really distinguished themselves, and it'll be the first time sort of for the year-end roundups and whatnot, when people have a hard time choosing among actresses' performances. I agree with you about Julianne Moore. I think she tends to be overlooked, and in a certain way she's playing her career very shrewdly, because she's giving herself chances to show what she can do, not just in Safe, but last year in Vanya on 42nd Street, I thought she gave the female performance of the year. But then when she's needed to play wifey, she can pull that off too and keep working, and you know, that's the way to sort of get a good portfolio doing. But we had a year of really wonderful performances by actresses. Elizabeth Shue in Leaving Las Vegas, who had played not exactly wifey, but the equivalent of wifey, girlfriendy, babysitter, all that sort of thing, showed herself to be an extraordinary, I mean, radiant a performer, you know, sort of unexpectedly taking everybody by storm. And I thought that was the female performance of the year. And she it's the whore with a heart of gold role, which is a cliche, and she turned it into something absolutely original, believable. You could believe that this beautiful woman, who in any other movie would be just cast as you know, the cutie pie, would need to degrade herself with this man and find redemption in it. I mean, that was acting. Another extraordinary performance was Meryl Streep in The Bridges of Madison County. We're used to amazing things from Meryl Streep, but this was really a very unshowy performance, despite, yes, another accent. It was a very deeply felt performance, and, you know, it was about an ordinary woman, a housewife, and it was such a strong performance that you came away feeling that there was no such thing as an ordinary woman, that there was something to penetrate in almost everyone. So that was a vastly humanizing piece of acting.
Well, Stephen, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about 1995 in film. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff. He's also critic at large for The New Yorker, and we're looking back at the year in film. I remember last year when we talked about 1994 in film, you described how independent film had become like the minor leagues or the farm team for the majors, and the studios were always shopping now at the independent film festivals looking for the next big young director or the big young actor or actress. Has the relationship between independents and the more commercial films shifted at all this year?
I don't really think it has. I mean, I think it still remains the farm team, and it's still, I mean, the Sundance Festival has become this very kind of sleek venue for independent films to filmmakers to show off to the people who will purchase them and turn them into whatever they're going to become. A movie like The Brothers McMullen, which was the most recent Sundance triumph, looked to me like a pure audition film, and I had no particular use for it. And it was packaged by 20th Century as a kind of hot independent product, and it was quite a success as sort of, you know, the emblematic independent product of the year. Look, it's okay. I mean, where is the talent going to come from? And it has to be nurtured, and it has to, I mean, these people have to make a living, and they have to be paid. But I respect those very few filmmakers who try to keep a foot in both worlds, and this includes foreign directors too. Someone like Stephen Frears, who keeps going back to England after having had a rough time in Hollywood and making the small films that brought him to people's attention and making them very well in a way that he can't make Hollywood films. That's a good program to follow. If you if you can manage to juggle both kinds of careers, you may really be able to make some good movies.
Last year at this time, everybody was talking about what a genius Quentin Tarantino was, and Pulp Fiction was, you know, on everybody or nearly everybody's top 10 list. How does Quentin Tarantino look this year, and what impact has he had on the movies that are getting produced?
Well, this is again an example of kind of symbiotic relationship, for better or for worse, between the independent world and the Hollywood world. I mean, Pulp Fiction was the biggest independent phenomenon in memory, and Quentin Tarantino became an international superstar. And he was young, and he'd come very suddenly, and probably there were lessons that he should have learned and had not learned. One of them is when people are saying, how did you get to be such a genius? You should demur. Instead of saying, well, I'll tell you how I got to be such a genius. It's very, very interesting. That's probably the kind of thing that will make people sick of you. And I think a lot of people are sick of Quentin Tarantino. I have no reason to believe there's been any diminution of his talent, except that, as we have long known, but as he has yet to find out, he's not the actor he thinks he is. But he may still be a very, very fine writer and director. There's no reason to think otherwise. Four Rooms is an experiment that has already failed and was doomed to fail, as those kind of anthology films are always doomed to fail, and I don't think that's any indication of where Quentin Tarantino is or can go. But he's got to be very careful. This is the kind of corruption that can ruin a talent, and he has a considerable one.
Stephen, what are the films on your 10 best list that are still playing that our listeners might want to see on the New Year's weekend?
Well, I think Leaving Las Vegas is still playing, and that's just a terrific movie.
Certainly in some cities.
In some cities, that's right. Sense and Sensibility has opened very recently and is fanning out around the country and should be pretty easy to find. 12 Monkeys will be opening slowly. I'm not sure when it's going to get into all markets, but watch for it. Toy Story, of course, is one of the great hits of the year and is still playing now. And believe me, it's not just a kid's movie. In fact, you'll like it better than your kids will like it, but they'll like it too. Nixon, of course, is still playing. Heat is still playing. I think Crumb, my favorite movie of the year, is coming out in the not-too-distant future on video.
And I should mention Persuasion, which is on your 10 best list.
Yes, is that still playing?
It's still playing in Philadelphia. Can't vouch for any other city. So, Stephen, what are you looking forward to in 1996?
You know, Terry, this is always a hard question for me, but this year it's easy. I'm looking forward to a movie called Lolita, which is being directed right now by Adrian Lyne, starring Jeremy Irons and Melanie Griffith. Melanie Griffith as Lolita's mother, I should say, not as Lolita. Dominique Swain, a new actress from Malibu High School, whom we discovered for this movie, is playing Lolita in it, and Frank Langella as Quilty. And I wrote it, so I'm very happy about its coming out. I think it should probably be out at the end of the year.
This is the first time you'll have a screenplay produced.
That's true. It's my first screenplay, period.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Stephen, I wish you a very happy New Year.
Thanks very much, Terry. Same to you.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air film critic and critic at large for The New Yorker. Oh, and I think we scrambled the name of the director of Toy Story. His name is John Lasseter. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf, Joan Tuohy, and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with Nicolas Cage. Our film critic Stephen Schiff said Cage gave the best performance by an actor in 1995. Cage's latest film, Leaving Las Vegas, is on Schiff's top 10 list. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.